May it please the court.
Counsel, my name is Fortios Bertzos, and I represent the appellant, State Farm Mutual Automobile Insurance Company, and the appellant is asking this court to reverse the judgment of the trial court in this matter, initially because the trial court abused its discretion in having the trial proceed with a late disclosure of economic damages by the appellee in the amount of $26,732. When this complaint was filed by the appellee in early 2009, the appellant answered it and sent out a set of interrogatories asking the plaintiff in this case, Ms. Olson, to itemize her economic losses, past, present, and future. On June 30th, 2009, she responded to that interrogatory by saying, an economist may be consulted and a full disclosure will be made later. There was no full disclosure made ever until 25 days before trial. Before that disclosure was made, the defendant had filed a motion asking to strike that future economic loss claim. After that is when the plaintiff filed the disclosure saying, this is what our visits are for future medical care, this is how much it's going to cost, this is the frequency, and that was the first time that was given to the defendant.
Mr. Bertzos, State Farm never asked for a continuance, correct?
It's a bit of a, not that clear, Your Honor. State Farm, in that soliloquy and that discussion in the record, the court, trial court said, do you want a continuance? There was a response by counsel for the defendant saying, I don't want a continuance. I want the trial court to enforce the rules of civil procedure. And the court said, I'm not going to do that.
Now, if we accept the I don't want a continuance as not being a request for a continuance, then what is the harm?
The harm is it puts the defendant in a terrible situation. The defendant then is forced to get ready for trial, to prepare and be there on the day that the plaintiff scheduled for trial. The plaintiff comes with a late disclosure, new evidence, and rather than do what's right and not an abuse of discretion, which is the trial court can either strike that claim or on its own, if it feels that there's prejudice, as I think the record clearly shows it had that feeling, it can sua sponte say, if the plaintiff is going to have that evidence, then you have to get a continuance and we'll do it later.
Yes. Did you ask for permission to take the depositions of the experts?
The deadline was over.
Well, I know. But did you, on that day when you had this colloquy with the court, did you say, well, I don't want a continuance, but why don't you extend the discovery date and let me take their depositions tomorrow or the next week before trial? You had over 3 weeks.
To be clear, Your Honor, I wasn't the one that
did. Want to say, State's arm, of course, I understand.
I understand it. No, let me put it that the record reflects that this conference was done on March 5 of 2010, where this issue was finally and fully discussed by the court and the counsel. Trial was scheduled for March 8th. No, on March 5th, there was not a request by the defense counsel to say, sometime in the next 72 hours, I would like to take the depositions of all these people, if that could even be done.
Nor was there a request as soon as you got the disclosure, a written request that said, please extend the discovery date, let me take the depositions now.
I agree. There was not a request to extend that. Keeping in mind the practicalities of trial practice, how that would have been accomplished, if it could have been accomplished. Also, with a late disclosure like this, the defendant would have been entitled to retain a new expert. Suddenly to obtain an expert to review the bills, to determine whether the frequency is appropriate, to determine whether the charges are appropriate, that's putting a lot of pressure on the defendant when the burden in this case, by rule, is on the plaintiff. It isn't the defendant's burden to disclose those computations of economic damages. It is the plaintiff's obligation, pursuant to CRCP 33, to answer those interrogatories correctly and not tell the defendant at some date in the future, we're going to get around to disclosing this to you. And under CRCP 26A1C, it is the plaintiff's obligation to compute and disclose those economic damages.
But why should we place the burden on the court, the trial court, sua sponte, to say you need a continuance if counsel are not asking for it?
I'm asking for the court not abuse its discretion. The defendant had every right to expect the plaintiff to comply with the rules. And when the plaintiff did not do so, it was inappropriate for the trial court to pick the plaintiff's side of the case over the defendant's side of the case.
Oh, but that's not what our law says, is it? The law says even if there's a violation, it has, if it's proved to be either harmless or substantially justified, then no sanctions are appropriate. So it's not a question of picking one side of the case or the other. The court's supposed to look at what the prejudice is. And didn't it do that here?
I don't think the court did that. To say that it was substantially justified, this was March of 2010. In June of 2009, the plaintiff had an opportunity to answer that question and didn't do it. And didn't do it until February of 2010 and never disclosed it.
So the court can choose among various options, can it not? Isn't that the essence of discretion?
Yes, and I put
it can say, yes, I'm going to strike this claim, or no, I'm not. And as long as that's within a reasonable framework for decision, the standard of review we have to exercise here is pretty deferential, wouldn't you agree?
I agree the trial court has a lot of discretion. And I put in the brief, there were three things the court could have done. One was strike that new claim. One was, on its own, say, I'm going to allow the new claim, I understand you're prejudiced, and I think we're going to go ahead and continue this trial so that everybody gets a fair opportunity to do it.
Let me stop you right there. You referred to it as a new claim. It wasn't a new claim, was it? The computation that you had was new, but the claim was always there, wasn't it?
There were indications in the records that the plaintiff might require future medical care, but there were never any numbers that went with it. And it sort of segues into the recent authority that the plaintiff filed in this case in the Saturn versus Miltair case, in which the plaintiff is claiming that that allows for sort of a late disclosure. But in that case, there was a spreadsheet of information and data that the expert was going to testify to, and that was given to the other party 18 months ahead of time. But nothing like that happened in this case. There was never an itemization until close to the last minute of this is what the economic loss is. It's not for the defendant to try to figure out on its own what exactly the plaintiff is talking about.
Did the defendant have access to all the medical records and all the bills that the doctors had submitted?
For the past, correct, yes.
Okay, so it had an idea of what the economic loss to date of trial would be.
To date of trial, not the future.
Okay. Wasn't there an indication in the medical records, though, that this care would be ongoing?
Not with that much specificity.
But I mean, she was treating up until the day of trial.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. She was treating.
And didn't the doctors say in their reports that the injuries were permanent?
Yes, but being permanent and requiring 7 visits with a massage therapist per year for the next 17 years are two different things. And in fact, when you look at the trial testimony, the testimony that was allowed added up to almost $72,000 in future economic losses. Between the massage therapist and the chiropractor, Dr. Abercrombie, if you take a calculator, you'll see that their numbers come up to just over $71,000 in future medical care. That was never disclosed either. I'd like to switch to the argument about the Pfeiffer versus State Farm case. In this case, there was also an abuse of discretion because the plaintiff testified that she was having trouble paying those bills, and the court would not allow State Farm to cross-examine the plaintiff on the fact that she had health insurance and that she had some of those bills paid for by State Farm. The record shows that before trial, the court issued orders in limine stating that State Farm could not mention the fact that it paid $3,000 of the plaintiff's medical bills and could not mention that the plaintiff had health insurance. Two instances on the plaintiff's examination where she said, the reason I got an attorney is because I was having trouble paying the bills.
Where does she say she's having trouble paying the bills?
They were piling up and I didn't know what to do with them. She's in the record.
But where does she say that she was having trouble paying them? I read her answer, she said, the bills were adding up twice, she says that.
And I didn't know how to deal with them. That's on page 133, line 4 through 11, transcript, March 10, 2010.
Where did she say she was having trouble paying them?
Well, I'm inferring that. She says, because, why'd you bring this claim? Because the medical bills were adding up. I don't know how to deal with them. The implication of that answer is they're adding up and she's having trouble paying them from a financial standpoint. And how does she deal with that? And not only did the defense counsel request to cross-examine her on the fact that there was health insurance, three of the jurors did as well. They submitted questions asking specifically about whether or not she had health insurance, and the court would not allow any of those three questions. So after she made those two statements, Your Honor, half the jury and the defense counsel wanted to ask the very same questions of this plaintiff about, do you have any source to handle those medical bills? And the court would not allow that. And thus there was a gap in that kind of testimony and evidence for the jurors. And in the recent case of a state of Ford, our Colorado Supreme Court pointed out that if there is a relevant piece of information that the trial court does not allow to be discussed, it leaves an evidentiary gap for jurors. And in that case, there were in fact jurors who had asked questions about the very issue the court had excluded. So we have kind of a thwarting of CRCP 116, which allows jurors to ask questions, because she brought up the fact that she was having trouble with these bills. Half the jury wanted to ask her about it, as did the defense counsel, and they weren't allowed to do that. So I would like to reserve my remaining 3 minutes for rebuttal here.
Hey, please, the court. I'm Walter Sargent. I represent the plaintiff, Donna Olson. State Farm says the trial court abused its discretion on 3 points. First, the trial court abused its discretion by not excluding Olson's claim for future economic damages because she disclosed her computation of future medical expenses 25 days before trial, and that's untimely. Well, that's not the law. As this very panel just 2 months ago in Saturn Systems versus Militaire on February 17 said, quoting Todd versus Bear Valley, the question is whether the failure to disclose the evidence in a timely fashion will prejudice the opposing party by denying that party an adequate opportunity to defend against the evidence. And if there is prejudice, then as the Supreme Court said in Traveler versus Citron, sanctions should be commensurate with the prejudice caused. Here, the trial court was given no indication of any prejudice. In briefing, State Farm merely told the trial court that the prejudicial effect was, quote, evident. That's all that State Farm could come up with. And in oral argument, when the trial court asked point blank what prejudice had been caused to State Farm, State Farm's counsel couldn't come up with anything. He just said, quote, we have the rules to follow. That's all he could say. Now, on appeal, State Farm suggests for the first time that it was prejudiced because it wasn't able to do some things like hire experts or conduct discovery. I'm not sure how the late disclosure of this particular computation prevented State Farm from doing those things, but it doesn't really matter because State Farm waived that argument by not making it in the trial court below. And in any event, even if State Farm had been prejudiced, it could have gotten a continuance. Olson's counsel said he would not oppose a continuance. On appeal, State Farm acknowledges that a continuance would have been appropriate. That's the word that State Farm uses. But in the trial court, State Farm specifically said that it was not requesting a continuance. And in fact, in briefing, in its reply brief in support of its motion, it said that a continuance is not appropriate. And State Farm's opening brief at page 11 and its reply brief at page 2 actually quote that language. Now, on appeal, State Farm, in fact, admits that in the trial court, it was insisting that Olson not be allowed to present a claim for future economic losses. It was not willing to take a continuance. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying this unconditional demand to have this claim struck. There was no indication of prejudice. The trial court was not obligated to choose between either striking the claim or ordering a continuance that no one wanted, no one asked for, no one needed. I'd like to turn to State Farm's second contention on appeal. I don't know whether they are abandoning it at this point in oral argument, but State Farm says the trial court abused its discretion by allowing Olson to use an allegedly privileged medical record to refresh her recollection at trial. As we pointed out in our brief, the trial court specifically said, I'm not going to allow her to look at the records. The State Farm is appealing a ruling that was never even made. In its reply brief, State Farm has come up with a completely new argument. State Farm says the trial court, quote, erred in even letting counsel for the plaintiff question the plaintiff about what she may have told the doctors at Mountain View Medical Group about the accident in this case. I have several responses to that. First, of course, this court has repeatedly held that arguments raised for the first time in a reply brief will not be considered on review, so this argument was waived. Second, State Farm hasn't articulated any coherent objection to the question that was actually asked. The question just asked if Olson recalled whether she had advised her physician she was being treated for injuries from an auto accident. In fact, the question was almost identical to a question that State Farm's counsel had just asked about whether she had ever mentioned the auto accident or the injuries to her physician. It didn't ask about privileged medical records. It's not clear why the question was improper, but even if it had been improper, Olson's answer was simply, if Mountain View specifically asked the question, I would have answered it. Oh, it's not reversible error to allow a witness to say, if somebody had asked a question of me, I would have answered it. So at most, it would be harmless error. So State Farm is appealing a ruling that was never made, is making a new argument that doesn't even say why there was error, and in any event, it wouldn't be prejudicial. Finally, State Farm's third contention on appeal is that the trial court abused its discretion in denying State Farm's request to cross-examine Olson about health insurance or medical payments insurance. Now, the trial court had already precluded evidence about health insurance and medical payments insurance, and State Farm is not contending that that ruling was erroneous. But in response to a couple of questions from her counsel, she mentioned that her bills had been adding up. That's why she had seen a lawyer. That's why she was filing a claim. State Farm says this remark opened the door to cross-examination about these previously excluded areas, apparently because this was an improper comment about her financial situation, as well as, and I'll quote, a claim of emotional distress due to her alleged failure to be able to pay or deal with medical bills. There's no basis for reversal here. First, State Farm didn't make a contemporaneous objection either to counsel's questions or to Olson's answers. Whether it was inadvertent or strategic gamesmanship, State Farm waited until the direct examination of Olson was fully completed and only then claimed that the door had been opened to all these matters that had been previously excluded.
And so how would that information even be relevant, given that it's the trial court that itself that deals with collateral source issues after the fact, after the jury, you know, renders a verdict and issues a determination of damages, you know, if there's even an award of damages in the first place?
Well, in fact, Olson's trial counsel pointed out one possible objection might have been relevance. Now, I think there's certainly an argument that it was relevant about, because the question was actually, why did you, 2 years after the accident, see a lawyer? And she is certainly fair to say, well, gosh, I mean, the bills were paying up, were adding up. She wasn't being dilatory. She just, you know, she didn't know what to do. And in fact, they were adding up. I mean, State Farm's trial counsel said, oh, all the bills were paid, but as Olson's counsel pointed out, that was actually totally false. I mean, there had been $20,000 in bills, only $4,000 had been paid, and State Farm's trial counsel then acknowledged, I actually don't know what was paid. But second, there's nothing in the record that supports State Farm's repeated representation to this court that Olson made a claim for emotional distress caused by her inability to pay medical bills. State Farm is just making that up. This case was about damages caused by the negligence of an uninsured motorist. There was no claim for bad faith breach of insurance contract, as there was in the Pfeiffer versus State Farm case. The jury instructions specifically limited Olson's damages, including any non-economic losses, to damages caused by the motor vehicle accident. And to the extent that there may have been, I don't know, but to the extent there may have been any discussion about the non-economic damages in either opening statements or closing arguments, State Farm specifically directed the court reporter not to transcribe those parts of the trial proceedings. So there's nothing in the record indicating that Olson either sought or received damages for emotional distress caused by her inability to pay bills. And finally, if State Farm is suggesting that Olson's remarks about bills adding up may have been appealing to the sympathy of the jury, we note that the trial court specifically directed the jury that it was not to be influenced by sympathy, bias, prejudice before or against any party to this case. In the absence of contrary evidence, we must presume that the jury followed this instruction, as this court held in Garcia versus Mekinen. An award of $10,000 for all economic damages arising out of a pretty serious car accident with permanent injury, that certainly does not suggest that the jury was overwhelmingly sympathetic or biased in any way. The trial court properly found that State Farm was not prejudiced by Olson's remark that bills were adding up. So State Farm has not shown any abuse of discretion, has not shown any prejudice. The judgment should be affirmed, and I just welcome any questions. Thank you.
Your Honors, I submit it's very clear that based on those two statements by the plaintiff, that the reason she saw an attorney and the reason she filed the suit, and this is a first party case against State Farm, is because she said, I'm having trouble with those bills. That is a clear inference of those two statements. The statement of, so the bills were adding up, so I went to get an attorney. The bills were adding up, so I actually filed this claim because of that. And to prohibit State Farm from ever bringing up the fact that it paid some of her bills and that she had health insurance absolutely violates Pfeiffer versus State Farm, because the gist of this whole presentation by the plaintiff is that she's telling the jurors, I'm having trouble with these bills and no one's doing anything about it, and that's why I sued this defendant. And this defendant was not able to bring in any evidence showing to the contrary, that even itself had paid some of her medical bills. And in oral argument,
Mr. Bertzos, was the jury informed that this was an uninsured motorist case and that State Farm essentially was representing the negligent motorist, so to speak?
Yes, if you look at the record, Your Honor, even the juror questions talk about, what is your uninsured motorist coverage? What does it cover? They know it's an uninsured motorist case. Clearly they know it's an uninsured motorist case.
But they would have asked those questions even if these questions and answers hadn't been asked, wouldn't they? I mean,
I'm not sure what they would have asked if these had not been here. What is clear, though, Your Honor, is right after the plaintiff said these two things, three juror questions, questions 34, 35, and 39 came in from the jury saying, why didn't your health insurance pay for this? Do you have health insurance through your job? If so, does it help you cover some of these bills? And do you have medical insurance to cover any of these expenses? The fact that these three juror questions were triggered by these two comments is pretty clear evidence that what the plaintiff was trying to convey is she's having financial trouble with these bills, and that the reason she had to file this lawsuit is because of that. And State Farm was deeply prejudiced by not being able to point out the fact that she did have a source of payment. And before I run out of time, I wish to point out in the record, there was a claim, an argument, and in the briefing that there were very few bills that were actually paid by the health insurance company. There's actually an explanation of benefits in that record where she submitted 26 of her visits, but she had far more than that. in her treatment up to the time of the accident, totaling $4,000. $1,000 of that was paid, but there's a lot more in past medical expenses that she either submitted, and we don't know what happened to it, or she never submitted it at all. The point is, it's not a matter of just $1,000. It's a matter of her triggering the jurors and the defendants' right to know what was going on with her financially, and the trial court did not allow that for State Farm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll issue a written opinion for you in due course.